listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Some progress Thursday in fits and starts in the march towards peace in Syria. Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu met with Stefan de Mistura, the UN Special Envoy for Syria, in Moscow Thursday, as another round of peace talks began simultaneously in Astana, the capital of the former Soviet Republic of Kazakhstan. In an obvious reference to the Astana peace process, de Mistura said there was no alternative to the official UN negotiating process on Syria, which was held in Geneva. Lavrov, however, said he would listen to de Mistura's assessment of the Geneva talks with interest, adding, quote, "In turn, we will inform you about preparations for the next round of talks in Astana," closed quote. Representatives of the UN, the US, and Jordan are also participating in the Astana peace process, which was reportedly set to complement the Geneva process. This was Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in Moscow Thursday.
As you perfectly know, over the last years, the activity on the Syrian front has increased. We have the Astana process. 1 year ago it started, and it's been developing under the umbrella of the three guarantors, Russia, Turkey, and Iran, with the observers from the US, Jordan, and with representatives of the Demistura's office. Today, with satisfaction, we can say that we, directly from Moscow, are ready to say that Stefan de Mistura goes to Astana to hold another round of talks with the armed opposition. and governmental representatives in November. We adopted a joint statement of Russian and U.S. presidents in Sochi on the 22nd of November. We had a trilateral meeting between the Russian, Turkish, and Iranian presidents. And as the objectives to eliminate the terrorist threat has been fulfilled, to a large extent, we decided to focus on the things which should be settled in order to give a necessary impetus to the political process. All that gives us grounds to move forward the agenda of political settlement. And that is the priority of our talks and the talks we've just had. I would like to assure everyone, because there are some who still doubt, for some reason, that, as President of Russia said many times, we would like to see a full compliance with the 2254 resolution of the United Nations Council. Due to the unsatisfactory level of Syrian talks in Geneva, we decided to discuss the steps which might be needed to have a more successful round next time when Stefan de Mistura decides to organize it, so that it would be a positive contribution to the direct dialogue between the government and the opposition of Syria. Also, we briefed together with Mr. Shoigu all matters relating to Russian initiatives supported by Iran and Turkey to hold in Sochi Congress of Social National Dialogue, just as the Astana platform. The preparations for the Congress in Sochi is meant to facilitate the work to comply with the UN Security Council Resolution 2454 under the auspices of the United Nations. We also touched upon the Syrian humanitarian situation, taking account of the Eastern Ghouta, Raqqa, Deir ez-Zor areas, as we both think that we need to build up the humanitarian support for the people of Syria, delivering the aid and support in reconstructing the infrastructure without any politicizing, without any shift of focus or interest of some countries, without any conflicts or exaggeration of tragedies, artificially staged tragedies, without any external influence or imposition of will or agenda of any other external player. We should be guided by the international humanitarian law. We should be unbiased, we should be frank and objective, and I hope and I'm sure that my colleagues will be guided by these very principles. I mean the coordination of humanitarian support and aid delivery. Today we also talked about the need to step up the efforts of the United Nations in aligning and coordinating the arrangements of the participation of it in the demining process. So far, the efforts of the United Nations has not been demonstrated or visible, and that is wrong, as we see, because when we speak about the humanitarian situation in Syria, any unilateral sanctions on Syria should be lifted, sanctions imposed by some Western states, which have a very negative effect on ordinary people of Syria. It was a very useful conversation, I should say. We understand that Russia and the United Nations, Iran and Turkey have common goals in that way, and these goals, I would like to reiterate this, are to comply comprehensively with Resolution 2254 under the auspices of the United Nations. And I mean the creation of a new constitution, all the preparations on the basis of that constitution for general elections under the control and monitoring of the United Nations. We agreed to compare notes further on and coordinate our steps on the way, both in terms of the developments in the political field and on the ground. Thank you.
This was the UN Special Envoy, Stefan de Mistura, in Moscow Thursday.
Yes, it was a very concrete discussion, very frank discussion, and it was also high time because we are at the end of the year when many things have been happening, and we hope the more progress and better progress will take place on the political process as well. I am planning to go to Astana just after. I just came from Washington and I'm on my way to Astana today, this evening. My main focus, apart from being aware of what have been the discussions in Astana, will be the seeing some type of progress on the detainee issue. Regarding the political process, I informed both ministers that it's true, the last Geneva meeting was not a good meeting, the atmosphere was not the right one, and I'm counting on the assistance of everyone, including the Russian Federation, to make sure that the next meeting can be better, and I'm planning to convene it in towards the last 2 weeks of January, so that we can better prepare it, perhaps, but also make sure that, as you rightly said, the focus will be 2254 in its own entirety, but with a special focus on the Constitution and on elections. Regarding the humanitarian situation, we are concerned like you are, and I think there was a good moment at the Security Council when I was there the other day, that there was a almost a unanimous type of feeling that there is a moment when the Security Council can actually work together to ensure that the Syrian people are reached by humanitarian aid. So we have some homework to be done between now and January. But this meeting, as a regular meeting, but in this case with an exceptional type of the focus, has been helpful to me in order to brief the Secretary General on the next steps to move. So thank you very much.
Lavrov and Di Mistura then took questions from the media.
RT, please.
Good day.
RT, Mr. Lavrov, after the victory of terrorists in Syria, we still see tensions over the fourth de-escalation zone in Idlib due to the large amassment of Jabhat al-Nusra fighters. Well, you, as one of the figurators, do you have any plans to decrease the tensions or to settle that problem in the de-escalation zone? And do you have on the agenda the question of giving the control over the escalation zone to the Syrian army? Mr. Di Mistura, question for you. You said that you are to convene new meetings in Geneva. So official Damascus already said that they support the decision to meet in Sochi, and the opposition is still silent. When you met with them, did you discuss that? And what kind of achievements have you have under your belt today? As for the fourth escalation zone in Idlib, certainly our aim is to decrease the tensions. That's the idea of the de-escalation zone, as it is. We've been working in that zone, in other areas, together with our partners. This time we work with Iran and Turkey as we guarantors, and we have agreed on the modalities for the operation of these zones, including the observation points and control, passport control points, supported by the military personnel of our countries. And this one is probably the most complicated zone, because there we still see the presence of Jabhat al-Nusra fighters. With them we conduct certain processes of that to put an end to their hostile acts. If they do not comply with the arrangements of the guarantors, the situation is unstable, then the military of the three countries would coordinate the necessary measures to put an end to these hostile and feral acts of them. As for the future de-escalation, for the future of the de-escalation zones, these are not permanent zones. They are existent for 6 months. It can be prolonged afterwards. It's up to our military colleagues in coordination with their counterparts from Iran and Turkey. But in parallel to that, I mean, to put an end to any hostilities and any hostile acts. The de-escalation zones are meant to be the root for a national dialogue in Syria, national reconciliation, because we want to first coordinate practical and pragmatic contact between the local authorities within the zones and then federal authorities. Matters relating to the delivery of humanitarian aid, free movement of people inside and outside of the zones and return to home. Also included. So this process of national dialogue and reconciliation, which we want to facilitate and we support the Syrian government on that track, would be all Syrian dialogue, all Syrian process. And this is why we, with the support of Turkey and Iran, we decided to hold a Syrian National Dialogue Congress in Sochi. As I said, we briefed Stefan de Mistura on that, as well as his colleagues, on what kind of work we do. And just next day, tomorrow in Astana, the parties are to discuss the concrete steps to be taken, who is going to be invited to that Congress, what organization will be able to participate, and in the statement agreed upon in Sochi sets forth that the countries will coordinate the list of the invited parties, and we can confirm that all members of the parties of the Geneva process are welcome to come to the Congress. So while we see the political process developing with the support of the Congress and as a contribution to the Geneva talks, we will be seeing more and more steadfast compliance to the 2254 resolution on the reinstatement of Syrian integrity and territorial independence, completeness. Thank you.
To reply to the point that you mentioned, no, we did not have in Geneva discussion about Sochi between the opposition and the government or with me at this stage. Today I was briefed once even more in detail about what are the plans, but I'm not making any further comments because I have to consult the Secretary General on this. What I can tell you is that let's go one step by time. And the next step in front of us, apart from Astana today and tomorrow, which, as you know, is focused on particularly the escalation and hopefully also on the issue of detainees and the mining, the next would be the Geneva meeting, which we are planning to have. And that would be an important moment to actually see where we stand on the possibilities of future political process.
Meanwhile, in Astana, this was the special representative of Russia's president to Syria, Alexander Lavrentiev, as he delivered a progress report to the media about the eighth session of those talks, which will apparently be attended by Mr. de Mistura on Friday.
We will also meet the UN Secretary General Special Envoy, Mr. de Mistura. He had a talk with Mr. Lavrov in Moscow today. We would like to inform Mr. de Mistura of the steps that have been taken here in Astana during the peace process in Astana, and to discuss with him the efforts that we will take jointly in order to hold this important event, the Syrian National Dialogue Congress in Sochi. I think it would be too early to speak of the tasks we would like to accomplish, the goals we would like to accomplish during this upcoming event. But the main goal, the main aim is simple. We would like to create a platform for the representatives of everyone from Syria and to try to solve this important issue of political settlement, which, which has seen no progress in Geneva. As you know, the latest meeting in Geneva did not yield any serious results. But I'd like to underline once again that we see the Syrian National Congress as an event to support the inclusive Syrian peace process under the aegis of the UN in Geneva. That is why we hope that this will be a great contribution to the Astana process so that we could find a way out of the Syrian crisis. Now I'm ready to answer your questions.
The U.S. doesn't want to leave the Syria Union after the terrorists have been defeated. They've seen a new strategy presented, the new national strategy of the United States. They say that Russia and China are the key threats to the national security of the United States. How can you comment on that? Because these things, they certainly have an impact on the situation.
Thank you for your question. First of all, I'd like to say that we are grateful to our American counterparts, colleagues, for their contribution to the fight against ISIS in Syria, to the elimination of ISIS in Syria. The U.S. acted together with the Russian military and contributed to the elimination of ISIS in Syria and to the actions against ISIS in Iraq. But I'd like to underline that the task of eliminating ISIS in Syria has been achieved. The goal has been achieved, and we believe there is no need for the U.S. forces to remain in Syria. So any reasons that the American quote right now to justify their military presence in, for example, in At-Tanf, on the Syria-Iraqi border, where the U.S. forces remain, justifying this by saying that this allows them to protect a camp of Syrian refugees, which is situated in the zone of their activities. Well, we believe these are just there is no grounds for them to remain there. The U.S. continued to say that they are still present to resolve humanitarian issues, that in the north, in the Kurdish regions, further bloodshed needs to be prevented, and the fight against ISIS needs to be continued. But these are all just words, just attempts to justify their continuing presence in Syria. We believe that there is no legitimate justification for their presence in Syria.
Archie, just to clarify, so say there will be a Congress in Sochi, and do you already know that there are certain members to participate? Because still there are differences of view between the Kurdish and other groups of opposition.
As for the date of the National Dialogue Congress, I cannot say that right now. We'll see at the decisions taken by the three countries. We have a number of options, as I've said before. So I believe that the decision will be finalized tomorrow. We believe that before the forum is held, we will see some more, another meeting in order for the three countries to prepare for the Congress. As for the list of participants, the process of finalizing this list will continue. We have agreed to conclude this process in the span of 2 to 3 weeks. And to finalize the specific persons, both from Turkey and from Iran, I believe that this will allow us to hold the Congress early next year.
And just to follow up, can you say, please, what about the participation of the United Nations? Will we participate in the work of the Congress?
We hope that the UN delegation will take part in the Congress because we do not see any other way to hold such an event. It can only be held under the aegis of the UN. Because all the countries are members of the UN, and we hope that the UN representatives will not only participate in the Congress as observers. I hope that they will take part in the Congress, and we hope that the event will take place under the aegis of the UN. We will talk about that with Mr. de Mistura tomorrow.
Представительство этой организации на этом форуме.
So that the UN is represented at the event.
Regarding the de-escalation zone, do you think it's necessary to increase the number or enhance the participation level?
No, the de-escalation zones have been defined some time ago. The four de-escalation zones will remain as is. Our main goal right now is to stabilize the situation for good and to maintain ceasefire, prevent all kinds of provocations and to make it so that as fewer people as possible continue to suffer and die due to military clashes that still take place. Another goal is, to solve the humanitarian issue and to provide the population with everything they require to live.
And what about the documents on the working groups? When will it be signed? Or can you give any details?
Well, you know, this document is still being discussed and developed. We hope that a work group like that will be created as soon as possible. There is an objective need in creating such a group because we need to improve trust between the parties. But this is a two-way street, because apart from the steps from the central government, we expect some steps on part of the opposition, which is placing all the responsibility on Damascus.
As you know, the results achieved in Astana are more substantial than the results achieved in Geneva over the course of 4 years. So will Astana be decisive in the political process? And after the Astana 3, the third round, it is possible, you said, so maybe it's possible to discuss the political process right there.
You know, the number of rounds of discussions is almost as many as in Geneva. As you know, Geneva has also held the eighth round of discussions, but this is not a competition. Astana, since the very start, was designed as a platform where we will be able to solve the ceasefire issues, where we'll be able to find mutually acceptable options for decreasing the armed hostilities. And this is something we succeeded in because we created the de-escalation zones. Well, as for Geneva, over the year we have seen the difficulties that the Geneva process faces. We've seen how difficult it was for the parties to find any agreement to even launch any direct talks, which still hasn't happened. What we've seen over in the last Geneva talks was that the opposition delegation, well, this time more united than before, still had some preconditions to remove the central government, Bashar al-Assad's government, and it has done this as the result of the Riyadh conference, and this was expressed in a very, in a quite humiliating manner towards the central Syrian government. And you know the terms they used to address the Syrian government. So what were they expecting? What was the opposition expecting when expressing opinions like that? Did they expect any kind of constructive dialogue? Of course. It ended the same way as it started, so there was no progress. Once again, we have talked about this today during our consultations with our Iranian and Turkish partners. We need to make it so that there are no preconditions. There can be no preconditions for the talks. If anyone wants to discuss the political settlement issue, they need to forget all the grievances, any grievances they've had before. We understand that this is a very difficult thing to do, because the level of mutual distrust is extremely high, and sometimes it's just over the top, but still, it needs to be overcome if we want to see any progress in this direction.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
To Sophie & Co. I'm Sophie Shevardnadze. The U.S. decision to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital has been condemned as illegal around the world, even by America's own allies. What will this mean for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? Well, I ask former head of the UN International Law Commission, Christian Tamushat.
The Israeli-Palestinian conflict is heating up once again, with American recognition of Jerusalem as Israeli capital causing riots and clashes all over the West Bank, and clerics in Gaza calling for a general uprising against Israel. What will the American decision help accomplish in the Middle East? How will the world react to Washington's move? And can the row over Jerusalem become a spark that will ignite more bloodshed in the age-old conflict?
Christian Tamushat, former head of the UN International Law Commission, welcome to the show. It's really great to have you on our program. Now, Mr. Tamushat, Trump's move to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel goes against the UN Security Council resolutions that the U.S. itself supported, like you said. So tell me, can the USA go against legally binding decisions that it has backed itself?
Well, the Security Council did not pass any legally binding decisions on Jerusalem, but there are many resolutions of the Security Council which focus on Jerusalem, and one of those resolutions was backed in the past by the United States, where the resolution said that all the measures aiming to incorporate Jerusalem into the Israeli territory were null and void. And this was also, as I said, already backed by the United States. That was in 1971, a very important resolution, 298 of 1971. And also we have the advisory opinion of the International Court of Justice, which clearly says that Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, is still not part of Israel, is occupied territory. This is what the International Court of Justice said, and I think this is the highest authority in the field of international law.
Now, if this whole situation, all those actions are illegal, can the Palestinians go to some sort of a court that would actually reassure their right to East Jerusalem, for example? I mean, what kind of court would that be?
Well, that's very difficult. There is the International Court of Justice that already in 2004 pronounced itself on the status in particular of the wall which was constructed by Israel on Palestinian territory. And I think we have no other court. It is the International Court of Justice. And it might well be that another advisory opinion could be requested by the General Assembly. For example, the General Assembly has a power to request an advisory opinion from the International Court of Justice. The first one was on the wall, and the second one could be on the status of Jerusalem.
So, as we established, Trump's move may be contrary to international law, which doesn't recognize Israel's sovereignty over all of Jerusalem. But the accusations of illegality don't stop anything from happening, do they?
Well, the question is, how can actions that are not compatible with international law, how can they be stopped? You know, this in a way is a weakness, a general weakness of international law. International law has no police force, no army. It relies on compliance, voluntary compliance by the states on the rules of international law. And in this regard, unfortunately, Israel is not very good, to say it fairly, you know.
UN General Assembly had a vote on the U.S. decision, and the U.S. envoy to the U.N., Nikki Haley, said President Trump is taking this vote very personally. The president himself said he will cut off financial aid to countries who vote against his decision. Will Washington achieve anything here by threats?
Well, the United States should not act by pressure and coercion on other states. I think this is not fair. This is not compatible with the sovereign equality of states. States must be able to pronounce themselves freely in the General Assembly of the United Nations and take their decisions freely without outside hindrance, I think. And if President Trump takes it personally, this is not a good parameter because it's not a personal matter between him and the Palestinians. He's the president of the United States and he should take care of the interests of the United States and also of Israel. I think we also have to take care of the long-term interests of the Jewish people who have an interest in peace and stability in the Middle East.
How unprecedented is this move by Haley, sending a memo to 180 countries, basically instructing them how to vote? Does this happen all the time in today's United Nations?
Well, you know, you can always, as a head of state, you can always suggest to other countries that they should vote in a specific sense. It's also your freedom of, as a sovereign country, to establish contacts with other countries, with your friends, and tell them, persuade them to vote in a specific sense. But there should be no pressure, I think. The threat of interrupting financial assistance
is
very inconvenient.
It does seem like Washington thinks it runs the United Nations, no?
Yes, that's, in a way, that seems to be the case. But Washington, of course, cannot run the United Nations. This is a community of 193 nations. The United States has a permanent seat on the Security Council, but that does not make the United States a master of the United Nations. That is very clear. There must be agreement, and we have to seek consensus within the United Nations. So Washington, of course, is not the master of the United Nations.
Jerusalem Embassy Act has been the U.S. law since 1995, but U.S. presidents from Bill Clinton to Barack Obama decided to postpone the actual moving of the embassy, not to jeopardize the shaky Middle East talks. The Israeli-Palestinian peace talks are at the same stalemate, like for 20 years now. Why take this decision now?
In a way, you know, we have to realize that The occupied territories now exist since 50 years. And I think there's time for the Palestinians to assert their right to self-determination, which has also a territorial component. I think the international community as a whole must make an effort to bring peace to the Middle East. And I think this is not only in the interest of the Palestinians, but as I said before, also in the interest of Jerusalem and the Israelis, because the Israelis have a true interest in stability and peace. But such measures as those taken by Trump do not favor stability and peace in the Middle East and in Jerusalem.
Exactly, seeing how sensitive and inflammatory the issues of East-West Jerusalem are, why would Washington go ahead and do something that causes this explosion of passions? American decision actually ends up endangering the security of its ally Israel.
It's a very bad moment, and the peace process might be killed now forever. There must be some solution. That is very, very clear. It's an inappropriate moment, and I think Trump is lacking good advisors who advise him on reasonable policies with regard to Palestine, Israel, and to Jerusalem in particular.
Trump has said he's fulfilling a campaign promise given to his electorate. So is this move about votes in the American election and not about the situation in Israel and Palestine? Is Trump pleasing his voters at the expense of peace in the Middle East?
Well, you should not really engage in foreign policy with regard to your electorate, your national electorate. International policies should not be dependent on the whims and fancies of the moment. So I think any state that has a role to play in international politics has to see consensus in a peaceful world, consensus with other nations, which also have a word to say on that matter.
Why is the American opinion on the matter especially important? It's more of a symbolic move than anything else, no?
Well, the American opinion is important because America, the United States, is a great power, a big power, and a military power in particular. And the United States can do many things, and other states might follow the example of the United States. If it's a good example, of course, states should follow the American example. But if it's a bad example, they should really heed the rules of international law, which are fairly clear. East Jerusalem, in particular, is not part of the Israeli territory. It is under international jurisdiction, and the international community has decided that the Palestinians have a right of self-determination. This is very clear, and people that have the right of self-determination must also have a territory and a capital.
United Nations can pass endless resolutions condemning the United States' move, and it's quite expected that the U.S. will veto all of them. UN General Assembly's decisions are non-binding as well. So does the UN have any political weight here? Can they really influence the United States to revert their decision?
I think in the long run, this will prejudice the United States, prejudice the interests of the United States. The United States is visibly isolated on that issue. And if you are a loner, if you act alone without the support of your allies and friends, this will put you in a very difficult situation and in the long run, at least, you know, be very harmful to your own interests.
All right, we're going to take a short break right now. And when we're back, we will continue discussing whether the U.S. recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital will throw a wrench into the fragile Middle East peace talks with Christian Tamushat, former head of the UN International Law Commission. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
listening to Weekday World from CPR.
And we're back with Christian Tomuchat, former head of the UN International Law Commission, discussing Washington's controversial decision to move its embassy to Jerusalem and the uproar it costs in the international community. Welcome back, Mr. Tomuchat. Now, I'm just wondering, why is the United States move creating so much controversy? If you look at it on the other hand, it's merely an assertion of what they've been saying for about 25 years. Besides, the Israeli government institutions have been in Jerusalem for decades, so it's pretty much just an acknowledgement of fact, no?
Well, you know, the situation is different. We should not speak generally of Jerusalem. There are two parts of Jerusalem, East Jerusalem and West Jerusalem. And East Jerusalem is occupied territories as determined by the International Court of Justice. East Jerusalem has an international status. It is not Israeli state territory. It has an international status. And according to the principle of self-determination, it should be attributed to Palestine. It should be the base of capital for the Palestinians.
The EU's Federica Mogherini has reiterated that bloc's consolidated approach towards the two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian problem, with Jerusalem being the capital for both. Do you think the EU is headed towards recognizing the state of Palestine?
Well, that might well be the case. I'm not aware of any move towards that end, and it's difficult. And I think this there should now be a negotiating process. Maybe Trump's decision, irreflected decision, could really stimulate a process, a negotiating process, because now there's so much talk about, so much discussion about the situation of Jerusalem. That could also have a positive effect, because people realize that Jerusalem is not just an object whose status can be determined unilaterally just by one state, the United States, which has no power over Palestine, the whole region, Israel and Palestine. The United States is an alien country, a third country that has no effective or no decisive role to play from a legal viewpoint.
The foreign policy spokesman for the German Christian Democratic Union, Karl Lammers, says Middle East, or the Near East, is called that way not because it's close to the United States, but because it's near Europe. With the U.S. policy in the region becoming erratic and unpredictable, can the EU step in and do the job?
Well, this would be highly recommendable, I think so. But unfortunately, I think the EU, under present conditions, is not really effective enough. It is not respected as a big power by both sides, and unfortunately, we have a common foreign policy, but that common foreign policy is not supported consensually by all member states. That's a very difficult bone of contention, and unfortunately, the European Union does not have a unified viewpoint on the issue of Jerusalem.
Who could be the most efficient at making the Israelis talk to the Palestinians fruitfully? Since the U.S. is acting too much on the Israeli side and the Arab states are too anti-Jewish?
I think there should be a meeting of those powerful actors. And also I count among them Russia. Russia could play a role also. I don't know whether China would like to meddle into these matters, because for China, the Middle East is a powder keg, and they are always very remote from the Middle East. They didn't like to interfere with those matters, but it's something for the Europeans, also for Turkey, the European Union in the first place, I think so. And maybe the European Union will be able to reach a common position on the Middle East in the long run, at least during the next month, because now it is urgent to come to some conclusions.
Lebanon and Turkey are already considering setting up their Palestinian embassies in East Jerusalem in response to Trump's move. Can other Arab states follow suit? Will this have a domino effect?
Well, this I don't know, because there are so many tensions in the Arab world, and Turks and the Arabs are not always of the same opinion. But huge efforts should be deployed, you know, because it's really a powder keg, and there could be some explosion that could even lead to war one day, and nobody wants that. And I want to come back to my position that the long-term interests of the Jewish people are peace and stability in the region, and therefore you need peace and some kind of consensus with your neighbors. That is important, to live as a good neighbor among neighbors.
Israel's intelligence minister has invited a Saudi prince to the country to facilitate and oversee the continuation of the peace process. Can Saudi Arabia influence make a difference? I mean, will this unlikely collaboration between Israel and Saudis last?
I think Saudi Arabia is one of those actors who should engage their best efforts in that negotiating process. And I would very much count on Saudi Arabia, among other actors. You know, they should all come together and push the Palestinians and the Israelis. And there should not be so much room for extremists who want 100% solutions for themselves, neglecting the interests of the others. When you negotiate, you also have to take into account the interests of the partner with whom you are negotiating. That is very important. And just one-sided measures cannot lead to good results.
Hamas has replied to Trump's move with a declaration of an intifada, an uprising against Israel. Will there actually be one, or is it just Hamas's PR?
Well, intifada, you know, I think it's an act of despair, because the Palestinians, unfortunately, have to acknowledge that the peace process is not making progress. It's stalled. And what can they do? Their diplomatic opportunities are very limited. So the intifada, I think that's almost a cry of despair, when people throw stones. This is nothing very constructive. But if you are in such a bad position, when you see no light at the end of the tunnel, there's no tunnel, there's only dark in the tunnel. And we need constructive initiatives, and I think from many statespeople in the world. And as I said, I would also invite the United States to revisit their declaration, and maybe they come together with Russia, Turkey, Saudi Arabia and others to bring peace and stability to the Middle East.
Hamas rules in Gaza, but Fatah and its President Abbas rule in the West Bank and are internationally recognized. Will Abbas support an intifada?
I think as a responsible Palestinian statesman, I would always look for negotiations, look agreement on consensus. But that must be also be offered to the Palestinian leaders, you know. There must be a hand which extends to them and tells them that there's a viable route to peace. This is what they need. And I don't think they are aggressive by nature. But what they want to live, to have right to existence in their territory, without being controlled not well treated by Israel. To be all the time under the control of Israel is not pleasant, almost unacceptable for a nation to be in a way subjugated. It's foreign rule under which they are placed, and they should have very soon their own rule. They should be free to make their determinations on their own fate.
Another aspect of the subject is that the number of Israeli settlements on the territory of the Palestinian Authority is growing, and they're so intertwined with Palestinian towns that imagining an actual independent Palestinian state is very hard right now. Is there anything that can make Israel withdraw its settlements from the West Bank?
Well, that's so difficult because we have the experience of the withdrawal of Israel from the Gaza Strip, you know, where the settlers, they fought violently against the withdrawal of Israeli rule from the Gaza Strip. And now to remove all the settlements from the West Bank seems to be almost impossible. Some solution must be found. Maybe those people would be in Palestinian territory, under Palestinian authority. For them, it would be hard to accept. That would be a solution for them to accept that these territories and their settlements also are ruled by Palestinian institutions, a Palestinian government. Why not? If it's a government under the rule of law, this could be accepted. But it must be, of course, a government under the rule of law without any revenge, without violence. But it's imaginable if goodwill prevails.
Mr. Tom Mushat, isn't the settlement issue, in essence, a lot more important to the conflict than the status of Jerusalem?
The settlement issue is extremely important. But brings the recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel brings everything into focus, and the fact that these settlements are growing is very worrying. I can recall in this connection again the advisory opinion of the International Court of Justice, which said that these settlements are unlawful under international law. No doubt about it. This is what the International Court of Justice said, and we have to respect it.
All right. Thank you very much for this interview. We were talking to Christian Tomushat, former head of the UN International Law Commission, about the repercussions of U.S. recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. That is it for this edition of Sophie & Co. I will see you next time.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.